From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. On today's JX, we observe the Memorial Day holiday in a sense, not by talking about fallen service people so much as by talking about war and its effects on society more broadly. We'll zero in on the First World War, still raging in the autumn of 1918. The geographic focus will be far from the front in Boston. That's the location Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith chose for their book War Fever. The story they tell shows the effect of the war on Boston and features three key personalities. One of them is Babe Ruth. He stayed a hero, a lawyer turned soldier named Charles Whittlesey became one, and the public turned against Boston Symphony conductor Carl Mook. It turns out he had been friends with the Kaiser, and that did not go over well. The authors of War Fever ahead on the Jefferson Exchange. First, the news. This is the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR for Memorial Day, Monday, May 27th, 2024. We broadcast to Southern Oregon and Northern California. We're streaming online at jeffexchange.org. I'm Jeffrey Riley. On today's JX, War in America. Not now, but more than a century ago. You'll hear about how Boston and some public figures fared as World War I dragged on. Babe Ruth is one of those figures, but this is not a baseball story. It's much more. You'll hear the authors of the book War Fever coming up on this Memorial Day. Stand by for that interview after the weather. Thanks for listening. For the holiday, a trip to the past, an interview from 2021. World War I was truly the first of its kind, a war that involved most of the world, and the world changed greatly through it. The United States took a place as a world power because of that war. That's the big story. A lot of smaller personal stories make up the story of that war and the domestic scene and the devastating flu pandemic that arose in 1918 as the war drew to an end. The personal stories include the likes of Babe Ruth. Yeah, baseball's Babe Ruth. He's one of several people in the focus of the book War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. It debuted a year ago, is now out in paperback, and is co-written by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. Randy Roberts is a professor of history at Purdue University. His many books focus on the intersection of popular and political history. Randy, welcome.
Hey, glad to be here.
Good to have you. Johnny Smith is a professor of sports history and associate professor of history at Georgia Tech. They co-wrote a book on the friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. Welcome, Johnny.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. And since sports fans may be listening, the two schools did meet on a basketball court November 26, 2006. Tech won.
We prefer not to discuss that.
Okay, I kind of figured, yeah, the Purdue guys never want to talk about losing to a school from the Southeast. So, Randy, start us off and talk about the birth of this project. It is a big one.
Well, Johnny and I were both interested in history, and particularly sports history, and that, as you said, the intersection between popular culture and political culture. And we wanted to, we were thinking about World War I, and we were thinking specifically about Babe Ruth. So we wanted to do something about Babe Ruth in the war and baseball during World War I. But then we wanted to kind of write a book that had multiple stories to it, kind of a braided narrative. And so we wanted to look at America in terms of repression, you know, the treatment of minorities in America. So we wanted to look at Carl Mook, who was the director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. But we also wanted to look at the battle side of the war. So we picked a guy by the name of Charles Whittlesey, who came out of the war as America's greatest hero. So the idea then was to tell three stories, all the people connected with Boston, but in the end, the reader would have a sense of World War One. You know, what it was like, the creation of a major hero, probably the greatest sporting hero of all time, celebrity Babe Ruth, taking a celebrity like Carl Mook and showing how the war destroyed him, and then taking a person like Charles Whittlesey and showing you how the war made him a celebrity and that celebrity status ultimately destroyed him. So it's a book of personalities, but it's a book of America.
Yeah, very different celebrity trends there, as you point out. Now Johnny Smith, Babe Ruth on the American stage, like America on the world stage. I mean, was he very different from earlier celebrities in how the public perceived him and how big he got?
Well, I think what we have to keep in mind is that when he emerges as a star for the Red Sox, he's a pitcher first. He's a great left-handed pitcher. And he's not a major name nationally beyond the baseball fans who are following him in the sports pages, particularly in Boston. You know, the big names in baseball is Ty Cobb and Honus Wagner, and they're hitters. Christy Mathewson, a great pitcher as well. But Ruth, really, his status and his place in the sport changes in 1918. And one of the things that we wanted to show is how the fact is that Major League Baseball is facing a crisis during that season. 90% of their players were eligible for the draft. And that meant that some of the big-name ball players were going to be in the service at some point, and that many of the owners were very concerned about their rosters being depleted. So what happens with Ruth is that an opportunity is created. The Red Sox had lost 11 men to the war effort by the time spring training rolled around, and they were going to need some help on offense. So after much debate between Ruth and the manager of the Red Sox, Barrow, you know, he's given this opportunity to play in the field and to hit, not just pitch. I mean, sports writers thought it was a huge mistake for Barrow to be trotting out Babe Ruth in the field on the days when he wasn't pitching because they thought he needed rest. And this was a moment, too, when the strategies in Major League Baseball and around managers was about small ball. It was scientific baseball is what they called it. It was singles, bunts, hit and runs, steals, sacrifices. There were no sluggers. But what's going to happen is that the sports writers who are trying to keep interest alive in this game and the owners who are trying to keep interest alive in this game, they recognize that Ruth is different, that he distinguished himself at the plate because he was swinging for the fences. And I think that's what makes this story so fascinating about Ruth, is how the circumstances of the war, they positioned him in an entirely new light, where writers frame him as the Colossus, this larger-than-life slugger who had once been a great pitcher. But as Ruth would say, you know, the fans, they would clap their hands when I pitched a nice game. But when I hit a home run, the crowd roared.
And so, given his druthers, would he have stayed just a pitcher?
No, Ruth.
Oh, no.
Okay, go ahead, Randy.
Go ahead, Randy.
Okay, yeah, no. Once Ruth heard the applause that he got as a batter, he wanted to bat. That's all he was interested. He wasn't interested in pitching. Barrow was listening to the experts, the supposedly experts, the sports writers. Barrow, and the belief was a great pitcher is better than a great hitter. But Ruth did not want to pitch anymore, and they were both two headstrong men that were just butted heads constantly during the season. Ruth was half the time he was threatening to quit. He was upset with what was going on. Barrow felt he was being forced to use Ruth as a hitter, and he wanted to use him as a pitcher, so it created a great deal of tension on the team. But Ruth, from the time he started to hit home runs down in Arkansas where they're spring training, he wanted to be a hitter.
And he certainly was. Yeah, 714 home runs in his career, not counting the 15 he hit in various World Series. This is not just a baseball book, though, I need to remind people. The book is called War Fever, Boston Baseball and America in the Shadow of the Great War. So Carl Mook is highly respected as the conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, but shades of Sinead O'Connor. How did he first get crossways with the public?
Well, in November of 1917, the Boston Symphony Orchestra is scheduled to give a concert in Providence, Rhode Island. And in Providence, Rhode Island, there was a man named John Rassam. He was the editor of the Providence Journal. And this is a time of yellow journalism, of sensationalism. And John Rassam believed that all Germans in the United States should be treated as enemy aliens, that they were inherently dangerous because their loyalty was not to the United States. Their loyalty was to the Kaiser. Well, when the Providence, Rhode Island, a group of patriotic women in Providence, Rhode Island, wrote a telegram to the Boston Symphony Orchestra requesting that Mook and the musicians play the Star-Spangled Banner. Well, Mook never got the telegram. The manager of the Boston Symphony Orchestra received it, dismissed it, because at that time, the Star-Spangled Banner was not seen as artistic. It was not an artistic song. It didn't have a place in a symphony orchestra. So Mook never knows about this request. The concert takes place. Of course, they don't play the Star-Spangled Banner. And the very next day, there's an editorial in Wrotham's newspaper denouncing Carl Mook and the Boston Symphony Orchestra as being anti-American. And that is the very beginning when you have newspaper writers and jingoists and uber-patriotic citizens and the Bureau of Investigation digging into Carl Mook. They wanted to know, the government wanted to know everything about his life. And what the Bureau of Investigation determined is that he had close relationships with German officials. He was close with the Kaiser. He was also very good friends with the American ambassador, Count Johann von Bernstorff. And von Bernstorff was the one who was directing a spy network in the United States. Now, the fact is that once the Bureau of Investigation begins looking into Mook's activities, in January of 1918, an agent who was investigating him determined that he was not, in fact, a spy, that this whole ordeal was drummed up by the Providence Journal's very own John Wrotham. But the story doesn't end there. The fact is that there were agents in Boston who didn't trust Carl Mook. They felt that his activities, his relationships, and what they would learn in private, in letters that he wrote to a lover, were his anti-American statements made him undoubtedly a threat. This was a man who commanded a large stage. He traveled throughout the eastern part of the United States. He had many admirers, many of them women, young women. And so there, these agents in Boston concluded that they had to do something about the threat that they saw in Carl Mook.
People were seeing threats left and right for several years, as tends to happen in wartime. We'll get back to our interview with Johnny Smith and Randy Roberts, the authors of War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. But first, because we have a little extra time, let's get more flavor from an intense period in American history. Here's a song from that era.
Thank you.
Henry Burr recorded that version of Don't Bite the Hand That's Feeding You in 1915. The song and the sentiment outlived that war. Judy Garland recorded a version of it with some very pointed German references for World War II. We'll get back to the First World War in Boston as we resume our interview with Johnny Smith and Randy Roberts, the authors of War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. We'll be back. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. This interview is from 2021 with Johnny Smith and Randy Roberts, the authors of War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. Randy, set the wider focus here. President Wilson did some things to drum up war support that seemed like no president before him had done.
Well, yes, he passed the Alien Acts and the Sedition Acts and made it essentially illegal to criticize him, to criticize the war effort, to criticize the United States Army, to criticize the Allies. And we're talking about getting thrown into jail for 10 years, for 25 years. Eugene Debs, mm-hmm. the socialist leader in America, and of course socialists were opposed to the war. They believed that the war was an imperialistic war, is going to be convicted and thrown in jail in Atlanta, I believe. Big Bill Haywood of the Industrial Workers of the World, same sort of thing. He's going to escape and go to the Soviet Union, Russia still at the time. But so the government was hyper-vigilant in kind of stepping on people's constitutional rights. If you opposed the war, you were in trouble. If it was believed you opposed the war, you were in trouble. I mean, there was a famous lynching of a German-American who didn't oppose the war at all, but he had trouble speaking English. I mean, it was a bad time. And we saw some of this in World War II, of course, with the Japanese Americans, but at this time it was German Americans that you better buy Liberty bonds or you're in trouble. I mean, even the idea of teaching German in high schools and colleges was forbidden. You know, dachshunds became Liberty puppies, sauerkraut became Liberty cabbage. You know, Salisbury steaks, Liberty hamburger became Liberty steaks. It was you had to prove your 100% Americanism.
We are talking to Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith about their book now out in paperback called War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. Johnny, or Randy, whoever's better equipped to talk about Whittlesey, we haven't talked about him very much yet. A lawyer, a quiet man, an intellectual, he really had no intention of doing things in public. Give us a sketch of him and who he's inspired by.
Whittlesey is kind of a member of the New England aristocracy. His father has had a very good job. Though Whittlesey was born in Wisconsin, he came back to New England. Went to Williams College. He was kind of an intellectual. He was certainly, I looked at his curriculum at Williams, and he took some tough courses, all kinds of languages and various other courses. He goes to law school at Harvard. He's a socialist early in his life, but he's an intellectual more than anything else. But he's passionately patriotic. And so when the Lusitania is sunk, he kind of abandons the Socialist Party because, of course, again, socialists didn't believe in the war. And he's going, as he said, Whittlesey's had fought in every American war since the Pequot War in the colonial period. So he's determined to do his job. And so when America goes into war, he's already had some training. He becomes an officer. An unlikely officer. He's tall, stork-like, huge strides. You know, people called him the stork, and sometimes. But he wants to do his job. He would have made a perfect officer in the back lines. You know, a staff officer. But he gets a field command, and he becomes in. He goes into an area. He does his job. He's supposed to, early in the Meuse-Argonne offensive, and we can talk about that more if you want, which is the major last offensive of the World War One. He's given a really difficult assignment. He gets to exactly where he's supposed to get, but the units on his left and his units on his right don't get there, and he becomes trapped in an area called the Pocket. And it's one of the most terrible, harrowing stories of World War One.
And this is where the name Lost Battalion comes from.
Yeah, you have a battalion-sized force, about 900 soldiers, follow him into this area called the Pocket. And I've been there several times. In fact, I was there at the 100th anniversary of going into the Pocket. And it's at the bottom of a steep ravine. And he's got Germans in front of him, and quickly Germans surround him. And so they are absolutely trapped. They don't have the rations because they're supposed to be reinforced that they need. They don't have blankets. To get water, you had to crawl to this terrible little stream, muddy stream, that was covered by the Germans. And so if you did it in daylight, you're probably going to get shot. They can't bury their dead. It's just absolutely terrible.
We are talking to Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith, both professors of history, exploring the meeting of political and popular culture about their latest book, now out in paperback, called War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. And we'll come back to Whittlesey in a bit. We talked about Carl Mook, the conductor of the Boston Symphony, who finally was talked into playing the national anthem at a concert, but then too little too late or something, that blew up on him. That same month, Johnny, Babe Ruth causes a wreck in Boston. How was that treated in the papers?
Babe Ruth was not the most faithful husband. And back then, the sports writer's approach to ball players cheating on their wives, visiting a brothel, as Ruth did both, but they didn't write about it. They didn't acknowledge it explicitly. It was sort of implied that, you know, here's Ruth. He's driving late into the night, probably had whiskey on his breath. And who's in the car with him? Well, it wasn't his wife, Helen. And so you could read between the lines if you knew enough about Ruth, about where he might have been headed or where he was coming from. But the fact is that in this period and into the 1920s when Ruth is in with the Yankees, is that the sports writers believed that their task was to create heroes, that Americans wanted to read about sports heroes. And I think this is where studying Ruth in the context of the war is really interesting, because I think a lot of people who know something about Ruth, they think of him as coming of age in the 1920s as the great Bambino with the New York Yankees when he breaks all of his own records, it seems, repeatedly, season after season, sets a single-season home run record. And so what we wanted to do is, by looking at his career in Boston, particularly during the war, is examine how the writers looked at him in the light of the Great War. And what we discovered is that as Ruth becomes this power hitter, really the first slugger in the sport's history, someone who was intentionally swinging for the fences, the writers portrayed him as a symbol of American manpower. They made these connections between Ruth's power at the plate and the manpower on the Western Front that was going to win this war. And they described Ruth as this inspirational hero to the soldiers who were reading about his exploits in the newspapers. And so it's kind of a fascinating moment to think about how the origins of the myth-making around Babe Ruth as a slugger can be traced back to the Great War.
Interesting. So where he, you know, he was the bomber. He was the guy who aimed for the fences. I mean, we I don't think the phrase is appropriate to the time, but the concept that we later came to call bomb them back to the Stone Age became kind of the American approach to war.
Right. The American approach to war is very technological. I mean, the American approach to war is always to be able to up the ante in terms of technology. You know, if your enemy has a knife, you have a gun. If your enemy has a gun, you know, you have a cannon. You know, you use artillery. You call in the air power. That's very much, and Ruth was like that. He was able to up the ante in terms of power. He becomes a symbol. And more than that, this is a time, I think, that baseball becomes truly the national game. That were playing during the war, and at baseball games, if you went to a game, you would see patriotic displays. You would see wounded soldiers in the stands. You would have maybe the teams would drill in military style before or after the games. Liberty bonds were being sold. Baseball was wrapping itself in the American flag and consciously promoting itself as America's game. The national anthem becomes not, it won't be used all the time, but it becomes much more familiar at games.
I find myself thinking baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and we don't need to include Chevrolet at this point. But so Randy, I mean, were we calling them Frankfurters before World War One, or did hot dogs come out of that time too?
That's a question I don't know. I think hot dogs had been around for a while, mm-hmm. but you know, did they go from Frankfurters to hot dogs? I'm not sure about that one. Do you know that, Johnny?
I don't know that either. Now that I'm thinking about it, though, I feel like in Boston I read some reference that they refused to call them Frankfurters. I don't remember what they called them, but they gave them some kind of Liberty-type name. But that's a good question for a food historian.
Yeah, the interesting thing, too, now that is to remember is Ruth is German.
Yeah.
You know, he's German-American. He comes from a very German-American section of Baltimore. You know, Ruth is his name. George Herman. Yeah, that's a good German name. But he's promoted as the Babe. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's almost like you don't, even though he could speak German, and he supposedly spoke with Lou Gehrig's parents, who spoke only German later when he was a Yankees, could speak German with him. We would rarely see Ruth referred to as a German. He was the Babe. He was as American as, you know, baseball and apple pie, I guess.
Yeah, well, and, you know, a really troubled childhood. You know, it was his family who took him to the reform school, basically the industrial home. And it sounds like he graduated directly from reform school to professional baseball. Was that the pathway, Johnny?
Yeah. I mean, he hadn't really grown up yet, and he's thrust into becoming a professional ball player. He has all this independence and he doesn't know what to do with it. And he's basically still a kid and he's traveling with grown men, you know, men who drink and cuss and are unattached. And, you know, Ruth is not sure really how he fits in. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, looking back, Harry Hooper, who played with Ruth on the Red Sox, would say that when he came to us in Boston, he was completely unrefined. And you would read these stories in oral histories with old-time ball players who knew young Ruth, and they would talk about how, you know, this was a guy who would go on the road with his teammates, and he would borrow his teammates' toothbrush and think nothing of it, you know, and he would put it back in the cup and think that, yeah, I just need a toothbrush, clean my teeth. He would belch at dinners with women when it was completely inappropriate. And so these kinds of things, you know, early on the players saw this is someone who was, in their words, uncivilized, you know, but he wasn't ever taught proper manners. And so he felt like he was just being himself. But I think what's interesting is that as unrestrained as he was in his private life, he played baseball the same way. He was a totally uninhibited man. There was this kind of raw sensuality about him. Everything was about being aggressive, and he attacked life every day. You know, we think of the 1920s motto of carpe diem, seize the day. Well, that was Ruth. He was completely self-indulgent, even as in his late teens. He always thought about himself. And it's something that we wrote about in the book is that, you know, for him, the war was something happening to other people someplace else. He wasn't really concerned about it. And the fact is, because he had a deferment, he never really had to worry himself with how the war was going to change his life.
So while he's very successful in baseball, and the Red Sox, in fact, are winning World Series at that time, they didn't win one for a very long time after Babe left the team, as has been pointed out a lot. In the meantime, this guy who can do no wrong, then there's Carl Mook, who after a while can do no right. Randy, what ended up happening to him?
To Mook?
Yeah.
Well, Mook is, you know, he's not a spy, but he's not truly an innocent human being either. I mean, he's guilty of libertine behavior, and he's guilty of just terrible comments about America. He had a real love-hate relationship, and oftentimes a hate relationship with America, and particularly American music critics and American kind of symphony goers that he didn't think were sophisticated. So he's caught in a hard place. You know, the government basically says, you either go to an internment camp down around Chattanooga, or we're going to try you as a spy, or we're going to expose your behavior with Rosamund Young and various other women that he was involved with. And so he's kind of forced to go to this internment camp and spend the rest of 1918 and into 1919 in an internment camp. And it's if you had money, it wasn't terrible. It was the conditions you were living in were probably better than what Babe Ruth lived in when he was living at the reform school, but it wasn't great. And for a man of Mook's dignity, of his sense of noblesse oblige, of belonging to this musical aristocracy, it was pretty difficult to take. It's really a kind of a sad story of a broken man.
We'll talk about the man not broken but enhanced by the war and his actions. That's in the next segment of our interview with Johnny Smith and Randy Roberts, the authors of War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. This is the Jefferson Exchange. Stay tuned. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. For Memorial Day, we picked a war topic from a previous show, an interview with Johnny Smith and Randy Roberts, the authors of War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War. We've talked about Babe Ruth and Carl Mook and their divergent fates already.
Let's come back to Whittlesey. He's the guy we still know the least about. And actually, I want to talk more about his brother, Elisha. He should not have been in the military, yet he was. What was the issue there?
Elisha was—he had heart problems. He had been kind of a sickly child, and he had had physical problems from the very beginning. And of course, he goes over before the United States is even involved in the war. He becomes an ambulance driver. There was a sense, and Elisha and both was at Harvard at the time. A number of Harvard students very early to go into the war. The war was among the kind of the elite of New England. It was a very popular war. They had been clamoring for war for a year or so. And so Elijah goes in, and he writes some wonderful letters back to his parents talking about what he's seen, and they're very evocative letters. And he survives it, though he won't survive long after the war's over because of his sickness. And while he's over there, he's probably exposed to poisonous gases, and he comes back with a terrible cough and has severe health problems. But, you know, he felt he had to do his part. Just as Charles Whittlesey did, just as another brother did, they all kind of did their part in the war. They felt it's what was expected of them, and they gladly went overseas and risked their lives.
So the idea of the of Lost Battalion, I mean, we had talked quite a bit about the role that the media took at the time in drumming up support, and President Wilson and Congress really wanted to make sure that there was very little dissent at that time, and in fact, they made it illegal. What was the story of the Lost Battalion inflated somewhat? Was the name applied later? I mean, what are the circumstances of what it had to fight out of in getting in the pocket in the Meuse-Argonne offensive?
Of course, there's rigid censorship, but by the second or third day, this becomes a story of heroism. Here is this unit of American soldiers trapped out in front of everybody else, surrounded by Germans, and against all odds, they're holding out. So it becomes known as a Lost Battalion very early, and Americans are aware of what's going on, even through the censorship. And when they're finally rescued, the offensive actually pushes the Germans out and allows the Lost Battalion to be rescued. I mean, here are these 900-some people go into the pocket. Less than 200 people can walk out. You know, the number of people that were killed, the number of people who were wounded was just amazing. One of the people that walked out, who was the second in command, you know, he had probably a half dozen or more wounds, and he was just in terrible shape. But, you know, these guys become heroes. And then they get back to the behind the lines where they're, you know, can recuperate somewhat. And the reporters are all over them. The reporters are saying, you know, what did you do? What happened? And towards the end of the event, the Germans wrote a letter. The German commanding officer wrote a letter to Whittlesey, to the commander of the American forces, saying, look, we see what's going on down there. We can hear the screams, the cries. We understand the pain. What, please, for the sake of humanity, surrender. And Whittlesey does nothing, okay? But it becomes, someone says, his commanding officer back and behind the lines, says, the reporter said, well, what did Whittlesey say? And the guy says, well, he said something like, go to hell. He never did say go to hell, but he becomes known as Go to Hell Whittlesey. It was like, remember the Maine, the hell was Spain, remember the Alamo. It's one of those stories that's told, and just the punctuation of go to hell becomes Whittlesey's rallying cry. It's something he didn't say, and he was embarrassed by it because he's a really mild-mannered, very private individual.
So then, I have to believe then he got parades and everything when he got home, which must have been quite a lot for a guy who was A, an intellectual, B, rather unassuming, C, not Babe Ruth, D, not Carl Mook. I mean, so not really seeking celebrity at all.
Well, he's the first Medal of Honor winner of the World War One. Yeah, there's parades for him, and he's called upon constantly to speak in public. He doesn't want to speak about himself. He says his first comment to reporters after coming out of the pocket is, don't write about me. Write about the men in my command. Write about their heroism. Do not write about me, which, of course, made him even more appealing to the American people, and they wanted to write about him. But he was constantly dealing with, you know, mothers, wives, sisters of people who had been in the Lost Battalion, who had been killed, and they want to know, how did my son die? Did he die bravely? And what is Whittlesey going to say? He was wounded, gangrene set in, he died in agony? No, he would say, of course, he died fast. And he had nightmares, he was haunted, he couldn't sleep through the night, and he becomes one of the honorary pallbearers for the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers, but it's driving him really crazy. He's sick. He obviously ingested poisonous gas. His cough is getting worse. His nights are getting longer. It's a sad story till the end.
We haven't even touched the other fever of 1918 yet. Do we know at this point yet exactly where the flu first came from? What became to be known as the Spanish flu?
Sure, Johnny. You want me to take that, or you want to take that one?
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, the Spanish flu. A flu started out in Kansas, in Haskell County, Kansas. And it was a bad flu, okay? It killed people, not in massive numbers. Now, Spanish influenza in the United States is going to kill about 675,000. But that's later. So this flu starts in January, February of 1918, close to a military base. and it spread as soldiers move from one part of the country to another country, from one base to another base. It starts to spread. It even spreads to Warm Springs, Arkansas. Hot Springs, Arkansas, where Boston had spring training camp. And people, and Johnny had talked about, alluded to this, players got it. And there's articles that are headlined, you know, the rain is a grip and the perfect storm type of perfect pandemic. Anyway, this flu sweeps across the United States, kills some people, but it's not an inordinary amount, goes over to Europe. And then it comes in August, late August, it comes back to the United States. It hits in three places in the world. It hits in Freetown, Sierra Leone. It hits in Brest, France, and it hits in Boston. And this is about the time that the World Series is getting started. And it spreads to Boston, and this flu that comes back has morphed. We now know today that flus morph. You know, they start as one type, and there's another variant. This variant is a killer flu that comes back. And it comes back during the World Series. You want to pick it up there, Johnny?
Yeah, you know, I think this is where it's really a fascinating story where Boston becomes the epicenter for this outbreak in the United States. You know, what we would describe as the third phase of the flu pandemic. In the United States, as Randy says, 675,000 Americans are going to die from the great influenza between 1918 and 1919. The majority of those deaths will occur between September and December of 1918. So this is the very beginning of the very worst of this outbreak. And in Boston, there are health officials who have observed that this is not just a problem that's going to remain over at the Commonwealth Pier, where these sailors who had come across the Atlantic have shown to be incredibly sick. You know, their skin is turning purple and their lungs fill with foam and they bleed from the nose and the ears, and it's not like any ordinary flu. Well, what happens in that first and second week of September in Boston is that sailors who were asymptomatic had infiltrated the civilian population. They were going to bars and saloons and restaurants, and there was a Win the War for Freedom parade and Liberty Bond rallies, and also three World Series games. So you have a number of what we would call social gathering events where this virus is spreading. But on the eve of the games in Boston at Fenway Park, where games 4, 5, and 6 took place, no one was telling the public specifically, don't go to Fenway Park. You know, by the time that the game 6 was played, the health commissioner tells the public that, you know, people should stay home, they should avoid large crowds, which would have included Fenway Park. But by that time, it's too late. This virus has penetrated every neighborhood in Boston, including Fenway Park. And so it makes sense that we could probably conclude that the games that were at the World Series helped contribute to the spread of the flu virus in Boston. And then what's going to happen is over the course of September and October, that virus is going to penetrate the interior of the United States. So a Navy ship went from Boston to Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, there was a even more terrible outbreak than in Boston that killed, I think, something like 10,000 people.
Big bond rally there, I remember.
The fall. Yeah, exactly. So, and there was a very, in the cities that hesitated to issue closure orders, the rate of infection was far worse. You know, as we know now from studies of that period and our own pandemic, that the cities that move more aggressively to have closure orders, to put in place what we call social distancing, they were able to mitigate fatalities. But certainly by the fall of 1918, this virus has reached as far south as Fort Oglethorpe, where Carl Mook is interned in an enemy camp. And it has reached all the way to the West Coast. So it has spread, but Major League Baseball was able to finish the World Series before it got really bad. The problem for the sporting world in that fall was that now suddenly in cities and towns across the United States, you can't have football games. High school football games, college football games were canceled or rescheduled, postponed altogether. And, of course, many of those college football teams already didn't have a roster because the draft had pulled the men away into the service. And so the bottom line here is that the pandemic in that fall completely disrupted the football season and other sporting events as well.
You mentioned it got to Fort Oglethorpe where Mook was interned. Did he get it?
We don't have any evidence that he got it. We do know that certainly there were prisoners who were very sick. In fact, Carl Mook's wife, Anita, was trying to reach him. She was traveling. Well, by that time, she was staying in the area. But they wouldn't allow any visitors to the camp. There were some telegrams that were exchanged between Mook and his lawyer who was with Anita. And he basically said, stay away from the camp. You know, it is so bad here that no one should come near the fences around the camp. And so he didn't say, I'm sick, but, you know, it's possible he could have gotten sick after those telegrams were written. But it was pretty bad there.
Randy, give us a final thought here. You guys had to do a huge amount of research to come up with this, but a lot of it came, I think, from the newspaper accounts at the time. As you read the Boston papers of that time, what really jumped out at you?
Oh, just so many things. First of all, of course, the censorship. You know, what we know from reading the history books that we've read, a lot of it wasn't reported. You know, the worst that was taking place in the war wasn't reported. Sometimes the worst of the flu wasn't reported. They were slow to report things. Beyond that, it was the sense that newspapers were trying to create heroes. One of the things that we need in wartime situations are heroes. Heroes of the home front, heroes of the battlefield. Babe Ruth was a hero of the home front. Of course they didn't report the negative aspects of Babe Ruth because they were creating this image. This is a batter, the power of America. And Whittlesey, they were creating a hero out of Whittlesey. I mean, it's such a terrible war. So many people died. It seems so senseless to some Americans that they needed these examples of heroes. And so that's what they wrote about.
Indeed, they did. And it's interesting what goes on after the timeline of this book, because then you have the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, businesses doing great, prohibitions in effect. We have the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, race massacres. The Ku Klux Klan take over the Oregon legislature. We'll talk about these on subsequent days. But this book is called War Fever, Boston, Baseball, and America in the Shadow of the Great War by Randy Roberts from Purdue University, Johnny Smith from Georgia Tech. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's Exchange. Find this and all JX interviews at our website, jeffexchange.org. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. We are back live with Tuesday's Jefferson Exchange, talking about vaccines. Oregon notes a high level of school kids getting vaccine exemptions. We'll explore. Also, we'll cast a line into the Oregon Native Trout Challenge and what it's about, and the Street Dog Project in the Rogue Valley works to support the pets of homeless people. That's Tuesday on the Jefferson Exchange, live at 9 a.m., with a repeat at 8 p.m. on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.